Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, happy Monday, everybody, and thank you so much for tuning in today to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill. I'd like to start the show by just taking a moment to pause and say that, you know, our hearts are with all of the families and all of the people impacted by the fires in California. You know, I know it was bad enough back in Northern California a couple weeks ago, and now all of us in Southern California have been impacted. And so our hearts are with the families and anybody out there who suffered any losses from the fires. And wishing all of our firefighters and first responders and police officers out there just safety as they go. My father was a firefighter for 33 years. So, you know, my heart is filled with gratitude for everybody out there trying to protect us. And today I'd like to talk about bring a fresh lens to your business and taking your business to new heights. It's a book called On the Brink by Dr. Andy Simon. Dr. Andy Simon is the award-winning author of Simon Associates. She founded and is CEO of Simon Associates Management Consultants, designed over a decade ago to help companies use the tools of anthropology to better adapt to changing times. Dr. Simon also is a public speaker and an innovation games facilitator and trainer. She served as a tenured professor of anthropology and American studies at Ramapo College of New Jersey and was a visiting professor teaching entrepreneurship at Washington University in St. Louis. Dr. Simon has appeared on Good Morning America and has been featured in the Washington Post, Business Week, Forbes, and on Bloomberg Radio. Dr. Simon, thank you so much for joining us today.
What a pleasure, and thank you for such a lovely introduction.
Yeah, you know, it's just life happens. The show must go on, as they say, but at the end of the day, I know that all of us here in Southern California, and I'm sure around the world, are, you know, heavy-hearted right now because of the losses that people have experienced. So I think that the only thing you or I or anybody else out there can control is ourselves and our thoughts and our responses to crises like these. And so I'm intending that today's show will bring a little bit of joy and empowerment and whatever people need in their lives to hear today. So thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Simon. And tell us a little bit about your journey. Corporate anthropologist is such a unique profession. How did you come to study to be a corporate anthropologist?
Jennifer, you know, when I started in anthropology, I was very interested in how people change. And so I was doing research on immigration and return migration. It happened to be to Greece, but I was particularly interested in how people really adapted their culture to a new environment. And then, of course, when they went home, only to find that that environment had changed, but in different ways. And so as I was doing my work as an academic, I began to realize that people really hate to change. They don't really like when I come and help them change. And so I became a consultant working in the banking industry during deregulation because it was very obvious to us that people who had to change because the environment was doing it didn't know how to. There aren't any business courses on this is how you change when all of a sudden the rules are changing, right? And slowly, I spent 15 years in banks as an executive, and then 7 years in healthcare, exactly the same kinds of challenges as managed care came in. And so people would say to me, I know how to take care of patients, I just don't know how to find them. And the profound impact of change was something that was quite humbling, but also something that, as an anthropologist, I both understood and knew that I could add some value innovatively to companies. So after 9/11, I launched my business, and I picked up clients almost immediately, Markel Paper, Centenary College, Montefiore Medical Center, and they all came with the same request. I don't know how you're going to do this, but we have to change. And so we've built a business around how a little anthropology can help your business change. And the book that you cited so kindly is about 7 case studies of our clients who all were on the brink. And what we often know is that their way forward is all around them. They just can't see it. And so what we try to do is take them out and observe it as if I've dropped them in Samoa. And they're going to really understand growing up in a foreign country, which is really their business, And all of a sudden they realize they do face painting and potlatch and ceremonies, and all of a sudden they have an aha moment. So, you know, when we launched corporate anthropology, nobody was searching for it. And now, quite frankly, if you Google it, I come up on the first page. And lots of people are trying to figure out how to apply it. So I hope that answers your question, because it's a great question. What's corporate anthropology anyway, and how can it help you?
Yeah, I think it's a great subject on both sides of the fence, because on the one hand, you have employers out there that have never had a harder time in this market capturing and retaining top talent. And so this concept and subject of corporate anthropology, I feel like, is such a sexy, hot topic because we all want to keep our best employees. But then on the flip side of the coin, you have the employee side of it, of our, you know, being concerned of going out there and job hunting. Does this company actually know what their vision for their culture is, and how is that going to impact me in a positive or negative way when, if and when I join that organization? So it's a really different sort of conversation and inquiry to engage into. So let's start with the employer side of things. I know part of your specialty is going into these different corporations and organizations and to be able to help them facilitate and manage change in these unique environments that are constantly evolving. So what is your advice out there if there are any CEOs, managers, entrepreneurs out there who are listening about how they can take the reins of their culture in their corporation and guide it?
Well, the first thing that we do is begin to wonder, what is the culture of today? It is not uncommon when we're hired for people to say, we have to change the culture, for an HR person to hire us to say, we must become more innovative. And my second question to them is, good, what are you today? Well, we are, and there's a pause. I had one client who had the CEO sign every check. It was a very controlling environment. And so when we started to talk about, you want to become more innovative and collaborative, what does that mean to you? We realized that the words had no meaning. And so, you know, to go back to your question, when we come inside a culture, we realize that language has meaning. All of the things you're doing have habit. And you've built a culture, because that's what humans do. You get them together, the herd is really strong, and we all begin to do things in a similar way. And so our clients say, well, you know, we don't do that here. I said, I know, but what you do here isn't getting you there. Well, yeah, but how do you change it? So now the question becomes, okay, we want to be more innovative. Give me a visualization. Does that mean this happens to be a healthcare client? Can nurses, are they empowered to make changes at the bedside? Oh, we can't do that. I said, well, will you change triage in the emergency room? No, I don't think we can do that either. I said, so what do you really mean by innovation? Are you going to empower patients to have more choice? And all of a sudden they realize that the word is there, and it's almost a cliche, but we really need to begin to, and you have to begin to tell us what that means. Then we need to figure out, how will we change behavior? And you know, whether it's Weight Watchers or, you know, post-cardiac events when you have to get into rehab, people hate to change behavior. And so we, like Weight Watchers, we begin to set a process into place, almost like theater. I say to them, think of this. Your behaviors today, your culture, are very much like a play. You know Macbeth really well. You almost go about the role without even thinking about your role. But tomorrow you have to play Hamlet. You're going to be more innovative or collaborative, right? Now, what's the script? Oh, I don't know. So let's write the script. Okay, good. Do we have rehearsal time? Rehearsal time. So well, you want people to change what they're doing. You want the housekeepers to work with the nurses so that together they get the beds changed faster, right? Yeah. Okay. Now, what will be the pattern for doing that? How will we rehearse it so that it gets into the habits? Because people don't really think about what they're doing. The habits take over, and the brain's most happy when it doesn't have to think. And so the process of change using the tools of anthropology are extremely valuable, because once they get comfortable with the fact that they are beginning to modify behaviors in desirable ways, all of a sudden it becomes much more fun. And often I tell them it's like a game. You know, you mentioned I'm an innovation games facilitator and trainer. We find that humans, when they start to play a game, relax. When they think it's serious, they don't. But games allow them to start to play. And you're laughing, but, you know, it depends on the metaphor. So whether they're on stage performing a new play or they're playing a new game, once we get going with a company that has to change, they begin to realize that they can, but it takes a little practice and rehearsal time, applause, and those wonderful hugs that say, ah, that was a great win. So I bet you're visualizing this even in the world that you know. Am I correct?
Very much so. Yeah, it takes me to the idea of those escape rooms, which are so popular. And my team and I did one of those last year, and it really brought out a different side of each of us. We were very playful, and we were able to think outside of the box, and it helped us to understand as a recruitment team how we collaborated and what one another's strengths and weaknesses were, which then allowed us to go back to the corporate world and to better play up each other's strengths and help support each other's weaknesses.
Well, I'm one of the areas, I mean, we're working with several companies now, and they've asked us to teach their millennials, and we're talking about cultural differences. The boomers, the Gen Xs, the Gen Ys, and soon the Gen Zs have very different cultures. But they said, can you teach my Gen Ys how to talk to clients? They've grown up texting. They don't even talk on the phone. and they really don't have eye contact. And so if I use the metaphor of a game or a role to play, they said, oh, I could do that. But if I say, you know, you're really not talking to a client watching their facial language, they look at me as if they say, what are you talking about? So the metaphors are important because you have to make it safe for them to try something new, and they don't even know that they're not doing it. Am I right?
Yeah, that's a very good point, because I find that often when I coach a job seeker before an interview, especially a millennial, and millennials and baby boomers have totally different obstacles when it does come to being effective or not effective at job hunting. But like you said, millennials have a harder time in general expressing themselves in a meaningful way and making that meaningful connection that a baby boomer might be able to make because it's how they were brought up. But it's what you don't know, you don't know, right?
Well, and they don't even know that their behavior isn't getting them to where they want to go. And so once they become comfortable about the fact that they're not bad people and it's not terrible, they begin to think that they can, in fact, become much more effective and productive, and their interpersonal skills can get them places. But I've had millennials say, can you please talk to the boss for me? I don't know how to talk to him. I said, well, let's practice. And I could do that. Well, yeah, so let's coach. So it's a very, now, as an anthropologist, you do this safely because you realize that they are grown up in a culture, and millennials grew up digital, and they text really well. We actually had a client whose salespeople were having a terrible time. Nobody picked up the telephone. You know, you love this. And I said, well, what's the problem? Well, all the folks who used to buy from us have retired. And then I said, and so what is the problem? Well, the new people are all 30-something. I said, and so the problem is, well, they don't pick up the phone. And I said,
oh my gosh.
I know. So now the problem is they don't pick up the phone. What shall we do? Well, if they won't talk to us on the phone, how will we get them to know what we offer? I said, I think the whole buying process has changed, hasn't it? And it has.
Yeah, I would have never thought of that. Even in the recruitment side, I think of one of my favorite millennial clients who's a dear friend of mine. And when she worked in the building, I could go up there and visit her and spend one-on-one time with her all the time. But if I ever called her, 10 calls might go by and I wouldn't hear back. And if you took it personally, you might go, uh-oh, she doesn't like me, but I love and adore her and I knew we were good friends. But it's just like, unless she saw you or was physically there or was texting, hey, let's go grab a drink or a coffee, it just didn't exist picking up the phone. So I can totally see that being true and not taking it personally. If you're that millennial or if you're the person trying to contact the millennial on either side of it, from an anthropological standpoint, you start to worry, am I doing something wrong? Do I not fit in with the herd? Is it me? When you don't realize it's a bigger cultural phenomenon.
And you know, when there are great studies about how much texting they do, and they're perfectly happy texting endlessly. It's communication. Well, what does that mean for someone who's a boomer or Gen X who isn't quite sure? And you said it so well. Is it personal? Am I insulted? Or am I just not understanding the better way to talk to each other? When they text cubicle to cubicle, you know that they could walk around and say hi to each other, but, you know, efficiency comes in. And you're recruiting them. You got to match them up into a multicultural environment, right?
Yeah, and it's funny you say that because about a year or so ago, one of my employees, who is a quasi-millennial herself but was a cusper, she started noticing that the candidates we worked with, and this would have never happened 10 years ago, preferred for us to text them when we had an interview. So she asked that we create a database button that said text message so that way we could track, oh, I texted so-and-so, and we confirmed them for the interview, where in the past we would send an email or give a phone call, but half the time it's just easier to do it via text and it's done.
Well, you know, as you keep playing this out, because the culture changes inside industry today is going to go up exponentially, because, you know, half the workforce by 2020 are going to be millennials. That's just, you know, a year from now. That means that and yet 70% of all the businesses in the U.S. are run by boomers, owned by boomers. Now, there's going to be a whole lot of interesting dynamics going on between those cultures within the business and with those who are on the outside, who are their customers. And so you've got the boomers who are dealing with their customers who are boomers, who are retiring or selling their business. Millennials now moving up, often their family firms. You know, 80% of America is family firms. And so they're going to move up in some cases to take over the business, changing things that were always done this way. It's a fascinating time. As long as you don't get too uptight about, you know, who the good guys are and who they aren't, because, you know, those folks are going to be dominating the business, and that's the environment we're going to be working in, right?
It is. So tell me, Dr. Simon, what's the solution? How do we have workability and a win-win so it's not a win-lose or a lose-lose situation? Because everything you and I are discussing, it sounds like one person is speaking apple and another speaking orange.
Well, they're both speaking English. They just have very different meanings for the words, right? Because I hear you, but I don't know what it means. So what's the solution? It is interesting to me that we can fight it, or we can begin to understand that the next generation, like the boomers before them, are beginning to now build businesses that run differently. And so is that bad or good? Do we judge it? Or do we begin to let them migrate the business into a different style in the hope that it actually is more fun, efficient, productive, a better business? You know, you can fight it. I actually had one client in the logistics business who had to buy ping pong tables for his employees. You're
That's
laughing. I said, "You're angry." He said, "Yeah, I'm really angry." I said, "Why are you angry?" He said, "We work 9 to 5 and then we play ping pong." I said, "So why don't you ask them why they want ping pong tables?" You know, ping pong is everywhere in Silicon Valley. There are contests among companies for ping pong contests. It's not incidental. And they said, "Well, we don't stand by the water cooler, and we don't go out and smoke, and maybe you should play ping pong with us. You might like it." And that's sort of that cusp of, maybe I can learn from my millennials about a different lifestyle. And then we had some physician groups. Physicians are fascinating, but the older ones, anesthesiologists, and the boomers had worked really hard for their pensions, and the millennials worked 9 to 5 and didn't take calls. You can hear already the tensions developing.
Of course.
The poor Gen Xers in the middle were trying to broker, translate literally, between the two. So the millennials didn't stay. They had 2.5 years, and they moved on. And the boomers were there for life. Very different. And so I said to them, why don't you now say to the millennials, you can only stay for 2 years? And begin to create an environment where for 2 years you maximize their time with you, and then, you know, help them move someplace else and pull somebody else in and begin to build a training and development. What is it they want to do in the next job? I mean, turn lemons into lemonade. It might be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think that's a great solution. So here's another question, though, for you. Like, let's say I'm an employee out there, and I'm looking for a position. Let's say I'm a baby boomer and I'm looking for my next position, and I have read your book and I've gone out there and I know what I need to look for to find the right culture for me. But then within a year, that culture shifts because they're trying to accommodate the millennials and not the boomers. How do you make adjustments for that if you're a baby boomer or vice versa, if you're a millennial going into a company that's baby boomer driven, that's not millennial friendly? How do you avoid putting yourself in one of those situations for somebody who's not cognizant of these changes or how that might impact their teams?
You ask great questions. It's a great question. It is a great question because invariably we come upon that. So part of the challenge, and I'll speak as if we're talking to human resources or managers, you need to begin to help your team, multi-generational, highly diverse, cognitively diverse, begin to respect each other and the patterns, behaviors that they do. And I say that for a variety of reasons, one of which is that neither the boomer, the Gen X, the Gen Y are always right. Cognitive diversity, and it's not just gender or it's not ethnic. I mean, people think differently and they can add enormous value to a company and the problems they solve for their customers. As long as you teach them to respect each other and to listen with those open minds and really look at things with fresh eyes. So if you're building a culture where you have different age groups, generational cultures, you need to begin to build some bridges. I'm not going to say it's a little like building ones with Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurdish and try to make peace, but it has the same qualities to it. Remember, we're herd animals, and these herds are having a hard time. So maybe it's a good time to begin to build the bridges. The second thing is that it is not that difficult to begin to see the value that each of us provide. You know, when the boomers said, well, we work long hours and the Gen Y say why, it becomes quite interesting to ask that question of you. And why are you working those long hours other than you always thought that's what we did? You also sat in cubes and the Gen Y doesn't sit in cubes. And there's one client that we know about that has no managers and they self-manage in teams. The boomers can't quite figure out what that means because they were always moving up. But the Gen Ys are perfectly fine playing like soccer teams. And their bosses could be coaches, but they're not directors. And then there's this wonderful possibilities when you're working this way for us to have new rules begin to develop where we're testing ideas and experimenting with them and beginning to evolve together. So it is a really cool time to collaborate, which is a word that we hear a lot of, but it's often difficult to do because the richness is there. The question is, can you make it really into something of great value for you and your clients? Remember, your clients are changing also. So it isn't isolated. It's very much inside and out, as if it's a blend.
Got it. So what question, say I'm any sort of employee out there, and I'm trying to figure out, okay, I do want a culture that offers ping pong ball tables and very forward thinking and offers me that work-life balance. Are there questions that somebody could ask in an interview to ascertain that effectively? Or is your experience that people will, for lack of a better term, blow smoke up the butt to, you know, just try and get somebody in the door? Do you find that people are authentic or that they will give you a BS answer?
The question is, what question are you asking? Because if you ask a straightforward question like, you know, what kind of culture do you have? You'll get something to come back. Probably an answer that is designed to make you think this is right for you. The question in anthropology, we often do storytelling. And so if you're a future employee of a place, see if you can get them to have either other employees or the person's hiring you. Talk about the stories that reflect the way we do things here. And in the story, you will find the values that you're going to want to assess and see whether they would fit your own. And I say this word very intentionally. You want to visualize what it would be like to work here. So it's not a crazy way to say, well, tell me, how do problems get solved here? Do people, you know, tell me some stories about recent problems that were client issues that we were able to solve. How did it happen? And if you begin to hear how the silos work, that's one way. If you hear about how we brought a team together on a sunset committee to resolve the problem, could be another. I'm working with one client, and he's telling me about the silos in the organization are frustrating him. And that's not necessarily the kind of place that a collaborative team player would like to play. And then I've worked with clients which are so collaborative, I won't name the company, but they're so collaborative, 30 people would come together for a meeting, no decisions would ever be made, but nobody's feelings were ever hurt. and you couldn't ask HR, you know, tell me about the culture. That would not be easy. They would say we're very collaborative, but then you realize that that can be really taken to an extreme and not terribly good place to work. And the storytelling is a very soft way to begin to capture the essence of a place. And that's really what you're looking for. So you can begin to see yourself doing that or not. And then the other part is that, you know, if you could spend this company that runs without managers is cool because they have the teams hire their people. And so they bring them in. And I share this with you because we have a podcast and we interview them. I say, well, how does that work? Well, you know, we bring in prospective employees, and actually we bring in a couple at a time, and we sit around in a group and we listen to them tell us their stories, and we begin to assess how that will fit with us. Then we have them come back and spend time with us, and they spend a day in our life. And then they come back and they work one-on-one with someone. Spends a lot of time because you're hiring a teammate. And then when we go in to actually do the hire, we say to them, this is what we really like about you. These are some things that we think are limitations. And this is how we're going to work with you to develop those skills. And they take responsibility for doing that. And I share you the story because it's a great model to build on the kinds of values the next generation has. And it's working extraordinarily well because the hires stay for a long time and the team invests in them. And then if it's not working, the team says, it's not working. And so it's very cool. So those are some of the questions. If you're looking for a job, you might start to ask and think about the story that you would like to be able to tell about why you're joining this company. And make it enough about something that would matter to you because it's, you know, we're humans. You know, the brain takes the facts and makes a story out of them. And once you get that story in your brain, you only see what fits the story. Does that make sense for you?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. It's all about your perspective and what you're looking for. Is there's neuro-linguistic programming says we have billions of bits of information bombarding us, and yet we only pay attention to several thousand. So if we're looking for bits that validate, well, to your point, we might go in there and look for bits of a story. I know I've made bad hires on my part, where I'll listen for bits because I think I already like the person that will validate why they'll be a good fit. And I'll ignore the several million bits that are wrong and then only pay attention to the several thousand that validate, oh, this is a good hire. And you're kind of blindsided or blindfolded, I guess, would be to the things that, because we think we ascertain people in a matter of moments after meeting them, oh, let me find reasons why I should probably like this person or not like this person.
Well, you remember, I mean, the neurosciences are teaching so much, but we buy with the heart and then we justify with the head. And so part of it is, how did it feel, right? What were the emotions?
Yeah, and it's, some people are good, and I have to warn my clients about this all the time. You get the people who come in sometimes and they are just polished and dressed to the nines and they seem to say the right things. And then next thing you know, you get that individual in the job and they were just basically selling you a line and they're completely different. And I've also seen the same thing happen with companies who razzle dazzle and promise the ping pong ball tables and the flexible work-life balance. And then again, they were just making it up to get you on board. So I think as an employer or as an employee, you have to bring awareness to it and make sure, look at the filters that you're listening to the company through or the individual through.
You know, I wish it were simple, but to some degree, let's go back, because, you know, you're buying into truly a tribe, a herd, a culture. Humans are herd animals. And no matter how much we want to make them diverse, birds of a feather flock together. And so you're looking to find others who fit. And the worst things I've seen are when people have to change the culture. They hire people to come in from other industries. I was in banking, and I had one guy who loved to hire people from retail or from the military. And before you knew it, the tribe pulled them into the banking business as opposed to having them pull them out of the business into a more retail environment. It was fascinating because nobody wants to be an outlier. They don't want to be standalone, do they?
That's true. And so I would imagine that's probably one of the biggest obstacles to change management is how do you make sure that the whole doesn't just absorb the newcomers rather than getting innovators in there and then having those innovators spark or ignite innovation, for lack of a better word, or new ideas. I would be curious to know your two cents. How do you prevent that from happening so that you just don't get more of the same?
Well, often I tell people you need a consultant. I know that sounds a bit self-serving, but at the end of the day, it's that thorn. You know, opera singers, tennis players, golf pros, baseball, we all have coaches. Outsiders to look at them and help them keep moving. Consultants have the same role. But if you bring them in, before you know it, they talk like you, they think like you, they are quite frankly easier to be with if they dress like you. And the effort of pulling, they don't even know how to help you move outside of that. So it's a very useful tool for to have that coach or that change agent or the consultant to become that kind of irritant. And I say that softly because you can only change so much at a time and you can only think about it occasionally. And if all day long you're trying to change the daily habit, you can't get anything done because you don't even know what you're doing. So, you know, we need to move people along in small stages, and we love small wins. Because the minute there's a small win and we celebrate, they go, oh, that's how you do it. Okay, let's do it again. And we try to make them in small pieces so that each time they get there, it now becomes repetitive. Because it's easy to preach, this is what you have to do. But at the end of the day, humans can't do that too fast. They don't even know what those words really mean. And my last little thought is sometimes you need to change the environment. There's a company in Michigan, and they had to go from being a traditional newspaper company to a much more online digital company. And they literally moved the entire facility and in the process had to let some people go and others come in. But they, by changing the facility, could change lots of dynamics. And space is not incidental to the changes that you're trying to create. So don't underestimate how you have to change something to change something. It's a little like migrating to a new country in some fashion. But what they found, and they spoke at a conference I was speaking at, they said, until we moved, nobody really believed we had to change. And then we moved and everything changed. So something that your listeners might find useful, right?
Yeah, I think that's very helpful because, again, I feel like we're all kind of out there like Christopher Columbus trying to discover the new world. And the new world is the marketplace. I was reading an article on LinkedIn, I think it was yesterday, saying that 60 to 70% of jobs that'll be available in 10 years haven't even been created yet because there's brand new positions and industries coming out that didn't even exist. I mean, look at just over 10 years ago when the iPhone came out, and now we have app designers and all these people who do different things, or Uber drivers, and that only came out 5 or so years ago. So I think we're kind of in the wild, wild west right now when it comes to careers and job hunting and corporate anthropology for that matter.
Well, you know, we're working with colleges and they are struggling because the talent asset officer from General Motors was at a conference with colleges that we were also doing work with. And he said to them, listen, I have to hire 10,000 people, and I know you want to teach them to be communicators, coordinators, collaborators, and creators, but I need them to be coders. So you can make them those other things, but I have 100 million lines of code. He said, and they have to last more than 2.5 years because it takes me 5 years to bring a product out. And they all looked as if to say, but we're teaching them to be socially minded, good people with social science and poli sci and liberal arts. And some of the colleges were religious schools. And he said, that's really nice, but the jobs are going to be in a whole other area. There are a million IT jobs open, guys. You know, help me. So there's this disconnect of who's doing the training, how they're training them, and what the student of tomorrow. I love some of the colleges that have reversed the majors. They now put the majors first and the general courses second. So if you can get a job after getting trained first, go right ahead. Interesting, isn't it?
I know. I think we should just all throw in the towel and move to Thailand and to teach English there. It's a lot to wrap your head around right now. But I think you've given our listeners so many wonderful things, Dr. Simon, to think about. And if you could wrap it up with, say, three different ideas that you would love for the listeners to take away today from our discussion about the future of corporate anthropology, change management, what would those three things be?
So a great, great question. And I love to end because that's what your listeners tend to remember. So the first thing is remember that the times they are changing and fast. And you can fight it or you can begin to adapt to it. Humans have evolved by adapting. So on the one hand, the question is, how do we do this? So and that means that we have to overcome our brain hating to change, the groups that we're in and the cultures that tend to keep us from changing. And so you need to go and intentionally begin to think about, how am I going to do this differently? Whether it's changing the spaces you're in, the jobs and how people work. And there's some great places to go explore. The reason that anthropology is so interesting is that you need to get out of your comfort zone and go exploring. You can do it yourself. You can hire an anthropologist to help you. But go outside of your comfortable area and watch what's going on. Undercover Boss is some of our best advertising. I bet you haven't spent time watching what your folks are doing, right? Spend a day in the life of a customer. Go hang out with them and see what they're really doing. And then begin to become much more anthropological in your ability to observe them. So if you're going to accept the fact that times are changing, you're going to realize that your brain hates it. You're going to have to go and physically do something, then all of a sudden you're going to have some aha moments. Once you have those aha moments, you're going to say, oh, that's what it is, and off you go. And on the way, remember your folks are going to watch you, so you're going to have to get them involved in the same process. We love to do small wins with lots of applause. Humans really do like hugs. So don't underestimate the fact that they decide with the heart and then justify with the head. So don't make it intellectual. Go exploring. Have some fun. Take them on an adventure and begin to learn about what's happening out there and how you can adapt to it, because you will do extraordinarily well and have some fun along the way. How's that, Jen?
I think that's brilliant. Thank you so much, Dr. Simon, for joining us today. And I do want to be sure that all of our listeners can find you, find your book On the Brink, or find you as a consultant if there are any of our managers, CEOs, et cetera, out there who are thinking, Dr. Simon has had some good points today that we might need to talk to her further about. So what would you say as far as where people can find you?
Thanks so much. So you can find us at andysimon.com. That's A-N-D-I. Simon.com, and you can find the book there as well. The book's on Amazon. You can email us at info@andysimon.com, and I suspect through Jennifer you can find us as well, but we love to talk. I have a podcast, and it's quite similar to this, and I love to interview people, so if you feel like being interviewed, maybe even Jennifer could, it's called On the Brink, and it is all about you and how you're on the brink and how it's time to change. So we can continue the conversation, because it's been a pleasure. Truly a great, great time with you, Jennifer, and I thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Simon. Well, it's been a joy to have you on the show. And in case you missed any portion of the show and you want to go back and listen to some of those salient points that Dr. Simon brought up, you can always find the show available for download immediately following the show on LA Talk Radio under the Get Yourself the Job page. Also, later in the week, you can always find us on iTunes and subscribe and listen at your leisure under Get Yourself the Job on iTunes. We invite you to rate us, leave us comments, any feedback, and or interact with us as well on our Get Yourself the Job Facebook page. Tune in next week as we speak with career specialist Andrew Coe and dissect some of the coming things to expect in 2018 when it comes to interviews, careers, and our futures. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Simon. Happy holidays, and please, everybody, stay safe out there with the fires.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.